You know, it's very kind of popular to have those bumper stickers that say support our troops, and we want to support them, but how can we really effectively translate all of these wonderful things that they do into civilian life and then make them feel like productive members of the team?
From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. November 11th was Veterans Day, a time to turn our attention toward both past and present members of our military. It got us thinking at Trending Globally about those at Watson who have served or are serving in the military. What should we know about the experience of scholars and students who have served? Maybe more importantly, what do we think we know that we might have totally wrong? So we decided to talk with some of them. And the conversation we had sort of blew us away. Eileen Teague is a former Marine officer and currently a postdoctoral fellow at Watson. Brian Brown is an active duty special forces officer in the U.S. Army and currently getting his MPA at Watson. Michael Muir is a prior enlisted officer in the Marines and a senior at Brown. Guest host Carrie Nordland sat down with all three. It's an amazing conversation, and whether you have a personal connection to the military or not, you'll definitely learn something new about this aspect of our country and community. Here's Carrie.
Hello and welcome. I'm Carrie Nordland, and I'm the Associate Director of the Master of Public Affairs Program here at the Watson Institute. One of the great things about working at the Watson Institute is having the opportunity to talk to a variety of different people. And so in honor of Veterans Day, we organized a group of students and postdocs to talk about their military service. And so I'll have them introduce, since this is a podcast and it's hard to see, we're all sitting around in a circle, and say a little bit about your military service and your background and where you grew up and just a little bit of bio just to get us all warmed up. Where it's morning time, so it's cold this morning as well, so we need a little bit of a warm-up. So maybe we'll start with Eileen.
Okay. My name is Eileen Teague. I am a postdoctoral fellow here at the Watson Institute. I'm also a Marine Corps veteran. I served for 4 years active and 4 years reserve. And my job, we call it our MOS, in the Marine Corps was adjutant. And that's more of like it's a manpower officer. So I worked for 2 years in East Asia, filling a lot of the manpower slots for what the Marine Corps does in that region in countries like Thailand, Korea, the Philippines, et cetera, particularly though preparing for contingencies for situations for North Korea during that time. And then for the second half of my active duty experience, we were working a lot in terms of sourcing to build battalions to send to Iraq and Afghanistan. So I was in ROTC. That was what we call our commissioning source. That's how I became a Marine Corps officer. And that meant after undergrad, I had to serve a certain amount of time. And it was a really great way, I think, to start off. I've since transitioned into graduate school, where I got my PhD in history. And now I'm off next year to become an assistant professor of international affairs.
So cool.
Thanks for sharing. So I can go next. My name is Michael Muir. I'm a senior here at Brown. I'm also a RU student, a resumed undergraduate education student. So what that means is I'm a quote unquote non-traditional student who decided to go back to school after a number of years off. The intern was filled with military service in the United States Marine Corps. I'm a prior enlisted Marine. But yeah, so I served from 2011 to 2015. I was a combat engineer. We specialize in a number of different things. The running joke is a combat engineer is a jack of all trade, but a master of none. And so we're very versatile and well-rounded, but essentially we support the infantry by providing counter mobility and mobility operations in today's day and age in the Middle East. What that looks like is a lot of IED sweeping and education related to IEDs. And those are improvised explosive devices, or roadside bombs, as they're commonly referred to. I joined the Marine Corps for a number of different reasons. I joined the military for also a number of different reasons. And I think the reasons behind joining the military and joining the Marine Corps are different. But in a nutshell, I had a ugly childhood and was really looking to get away and you know, go out and seek a sense of adventure and camaraderie and find a family that I didn't really have growing up. And I would like to think that I found that and still am exposed to that Marine Corps family in particular, even to this day and age. I think the enlisted side is particularly interesting because you do get a really good glimpse into this sector of society, of American society, that I think is encompassing in of just about everybody under the sun. It's an incredibly diverse force, particularly on the enlisted side. And so it was a pleasure to sort of have access into that, or, you know, catch a glimpse of that that side of the military.
Can I add just Please. Two garnishing comments to what he said? Very quickly. I mean, one, that the enlisted path, just to kind of bring it to terminology, you know, people could understand a little bit more. I mean, when people envision Marine Corps boot camp, like in you know, Full Metal Jacket movies, and that sort of thing, I mean, that is what, you know, that is what you went through, you know, like
so the
that,
yelling. And
yeah,
the
yelling. I mean, I went to total, officer candidate school and they do their own thing of that. But when people think about Paris Island, Marine Corps boot camp, this is what you went through, you know, and this is like where they make a Marine. I mean, and then also the MOS of combat engineer, because I've worked a lot of combat engineers. I mean, this is like one of the most significant MOSs. I mean, everybody, you know, talks about the infantry and that sort of thing. I mean, but this day and age in Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, we're dealing with clearing IEDs, with getting across bridges, a lot of times with, like, you know, does that sound like with blowing things up, you know? And I mean, these are the kinds of things that, you know, combat engineer, you know, units and companies, you know, are doing. And they're very significant today, especially when many service members are have casualty counts because of the fact that because of IEDs, because of these explosives. And so, I mean, it's very important work and very interesting work.
What's the MOS?
Sorry, I keep on saying that.
No, that's okay.
Marines, it's the military occupational specialty. And they actually use that same term in the Army as well. Okay. It's basically what your job is.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was actually going to touch on that just because there is a difference between MOS and job. There's a lot of jobs you can have without changing your MOS.
Oh, that's true. That's true. But for all intents and purposes,
right.
Like,
except
you know.
For that, in my intro, I will say that I had multiple jobs and also a couple MOSs throughout my time. So I'm Brian Brown. I've been in the Army for 10 years now. I commissioned through a different source, Officer Candidate School, exclusively. So I had the unique experience of going to boot camp, where in the Army it's called basic combat training, as an enlisted soldier, but immediately went to Officer Candidate School in 2009, 2010 timeframe, and became an officer there. And from there, I went to the infantry, and I served in an infantry unit for almost 4 years. I was an infantry platoon leader in Afghanistan for 9 months, and then came back and became an executive officer while still being an infantry officer. So that's why I say new job, different, same MOS, new job. Okay. But I was an executive officer at that point, which is second in command, but it's really the logistics. On that next deployment that I went on to Afghanistan, I was more in charge of ordering fuel, food, water, bullets, making sure all the property was accounted for, and just overall running the logistical scene for an infantry company. From there, I went and tried out for Special Forces. I got picked, and then that was like 2 years of training about to become a Green Beret. And I became a detachment commander in 2016, which is the top position on a 12-man team of Green Berets. And I was in 5th Group, which is the Middle East. It's broken down into 5 regions, the world, and the Middle East is 5th Group's region. So I did 2 deployments to Syria during that time frame.
So just to get a sense of scope, when you talk about logistics, how many people are in an infantry? And I mean, logistics is like the heart and soul of any operation. So can you just talk about, again, the scope of the work that you were doing when you were doing that?
Sure. So it was probably pretty small in scope when you think about it, but it's 30-man platoon was when I was a platoon leader. And in an infantry company, there's typically 3 or 4 platoons.
Okay.
So about 160 guys, once you incorporate the staff that also works, the company commander, and then you have supply sergeants.
Right.
And so on the deployment where I was running the logistics, it was 160 guys plus a small contingent of partner force members from the Afghan National Army. And it was just ordering, like I said, fuel, water, bullets, keeping the combat outpost running.
Yeah, but that's huge because, I mean, if there aren't enough, if there isn't water, that's like kind of a big deal.
Yeah, it is.
Kind of an obvious point. But
very important work, less fun work, but very important.
But heavy responsibility because,
of course,
I mean, you know, yeah. don't have dinner.
People, yeah, people will be pretty angry without dinner, yeah. and people yeah. can't do missions without fuel or
yes.
bullets.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Beans, bullets, band-aids. That's the old adage, right?
That's right.
So Brian, you mentioned Syria and Afghanistan. Where were the other places? Were other venues?
Theaters.
Where are the theaters where you served, Eileen?
I served in Asia, based out of Japan. There's a big Marine Corps base there, and I was stationed for the rest of the time at headquarters in Southern California, which is another big base of the Marine Corps at Camp Pendleton.
I was also stationed at Camp Pendleton. That was my home base, if you will. And then from there, deployed in support of the 13th Marine Expeditionary Unit. And this is sort of a global readiness military contingent that is sort of at any moment in time, we have troops floating around the world or mm-hmm. conducting training exercises with some of our allies. And so I was part of that. So I traveled pretty heavily throughout Southeast Asia, went to the Philippines and Singapore, and then ventured into the Middle East, spent some time in Jordan, Israel, Djibouti mm-hmm. For a number of months, Kuwait, Oman, probably a couple of other places that I can't even remember, UAE predominantly yeah. as well. Yeah. So I had a pretty, you know, cool experience, if you will. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I was looking to do mm-hmm. in the first place was leave and go out and see the world. And mm-hmm. so I just fortunately fell into the right place and the right time and got to do that and got to interact with people, again, from all over the world, mm-hmm. not just Marines, which was pretty cool for me.
So you each talked about the camaraderie and the team like atmosphere and those bonds. What I guess, how are those forged? How have you each experienced that? I mean, does this happen? I mean, sure, it happens in a variety of different ways, but talk about the experience in terms of the connections that you made with your fellow service people.
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly forged through shared struggle, and a lot of that's by design. The training is intentionally challenging. You're sleep deprived, you're hungry, you're out in the cold, and you're going through it together. And really, in hindsight, when I think back on like my life, like the best memories I have on the lacrosse field were in those same sort of conditions, were like the worst at the time. And I don't know if that's the same for everybody, but when you put that into the military atmosphere, it builds those bonds, and you can look back on those times and laugh. And I don't know, just struggling with people really builds relationships with people. And then, of course, there's obviously on deployment some more extreme circumstances where it's shared struggle or tragedy or catastrophe. But even in training, before you go anywhere with them, you've already sort of at least begun to establish these bonds. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say shared struggle as well. And also, I think there's just a very rich culture, a tradition. Mm-hmm. Speaking from the Marine Corps perspective, this is just ingrained in us from day one, this sense of tradition. And when you can share in that as well, naturally you're going to develop close bonds with people to the point where even if I had never met another Marine prior and then did like today, yeah. I already have a very firm base of common understanding with Eileen, a shared culture, a shared esprit de corps, sometimes what we call it. And it's very significant and sounds, you know, maybe kind of silly, but since getting out of the Marine Corps, coming to Brown and being involved in a number of different communities, I have found that some of the closest connections I've made
yeah.
were Marines or just veterans in general mm-hmm. That I was able to immediately establish some sort of connection with. And to me, that's very interesting. And I think I remember talking to you, Carrie, about this idea of institutional memory. And since being here at Brown, I've become really fascinated with this concept that certain organizations or institutions are able to instill such a spirit mm-hmm. of camaraderie mm-hmm. despite an average tenure of any individual within the organization being 3 or 4 years, let's say, in the military. Schools, Brown, for example, does the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. This has a very rich culture and history. 1764, this school is older than the nation itself. And yet it is still able to perpetuate and continue this the same mission, the same values, and the same culture day in and day out, despite the students and the professors and the faculty and administration constantly turning over. Mm-hmm. The military is another great example of that. So it's fascinating for me to think about.
Yeah, I think to add to that, I think you put it really nice, Mike. I mean, two things. Like one, like this idea of these ingrained structures that you learn, I just think that that's fascinating. And to kind of come through it from another angle, I think that, you know, when you go into a lot of organizations, like, you know, there's this kind of push for diversity and diverse voices and bringing people of different backgrounds together to speak. And I think that that's such a great thing that's happening so deliberately now in workplaces and in campuses across the country. But what I think is fascinating when you go back and look at, you know, our experience in the military, in the Marine Corps, I mean, you're already getting all of these people that come from such different socioeconomic, ethnic, regional backgrounds, and you're teaching them a language in a sense that they can, you know, automatically kind of just communicate regardless of, you know, what their preferences are in a certain situation politically, you know, whatever. They can still work together. They can still communicate with each other, and they can usually find some sort of common ground and understanding very quickly. And I think that that's amazing about the military, because it doesn't really necessarily, like, you know, say like this is diversity or we're going to put this diversity initiative, but it happens for, I mean, it's not perfect, but it happens. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really amazing thing when you're traveling, because I also traveled extensively throughout Asia. In my work. And it's, I mean, even sometimes those kind of values work with foreign militaries as well, in terms of the backgrounds and the connections, and the work relationships that you're able to build. And then the second thing is, I think that, you know, for good and for bad, being in the military, you know, very much shaped my conceptions of mentorship. And I think a lot of the connections that are forged are really kind of driven by the mentorship that you receive in the military. I think that people feel that, like, anyone that's subordinate to them, I mean, at least the good leaders are, you know, that they should take care of them, that they have a responsibility for them. Whereas in a lot of cases, like, a mentor is just like, okay, I'm going to provide you guidance. But in the military, or at least in the Marine Corps, there's this sort of, like, you know, ownership that if the person that is underneath you is not successful, then that's a reflection of yourself. And so you should work to help make that person, you know, more successful. And that works, you know, all the way up the chain collectively, so that as a whole, you know, the team can do better.
No, I think you're right. Mentorship, I think we think, oh, it's helping someone get a job. And then once you have that job, like, we're like, okay, it's great. Good luck doing that thing. But it's not the full package of really talking about every single angle of a professional or personal life and thinking about all those different aspects that we bring together as a human.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, to highlight that point, you're rarely, as a leader, evaluated on what you're capable of doing. It's always on how your team ends up performing, and they measure you on a ton of metrics, to include how many people are leaving your organization. So I think the way that it's structured, for all the faults people point out in the military, the way that they evaluate you based on the performance of your subordinates really drives a culture of mentorship and helping people succeed, even if it takes time out of your day, because that is still your job, and it's clear. It's not just part of your job. Like, that is what you're being evaluated on. So
it's really interesting. Yeah, I guess I never even really thought about that my performance was, especially as I moved up in rank, was really tied directly to those underneath me.
And this is at the enlisted and officer level. You know, if you're a sergeant, which is someone who's been in, depending on the service, like 8 to 10 years, I mean, you are in charge of 7 to 10 Marines possibly. And, you know, their performance, I mean, their ability to integrate is a reflection of that sergeant, for example. And I'm still getting emails, you know, today from, you know, from superior officers I had when I was a second lieutenant, which is like, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. And, you know, and they're still like almost like checking in on me, like on my progress in academia, saying, oh, we're so proud of you. Like, how's it going? You know what I mean? And that's what I really mean about, you know, about the follow through. You know, it's not even, they're not even my, you know, my boss anymore.
Right. But like the care and the thoughtfulness.
But the care and the thoughtfulness and the follow through. Yeah. And, you know, and I think that's, it's exceptional.
Yeah. I want to transition to your transitions from the military to the classroom. And I know, Brian, it's slightly different because you're still doing balancing both. But of course, there's always shifts when you move from one aspect of your life to another. But what was the shifts that you had to do mentally, physically, otherwise, from your time in the service to the classrooms? And I guess I'm just really curious about how you kind of moved and transitioned and shifted in your way of thinking, or maybe there wasn't any.
No, there definitely was to some degree. And like you said, I am still in the Army. So I don't think I mentioned it earlier, but I'm just here to get my master's degree. And then I immediately go back to active duty. I have really limited responsibilities in the interim while I'm here. But for right now, it's always nice to just take a breather and know that you're not going to get a phone call late at night, or you're not going to get called into the office. Like, you are just doing you, and you're focusing on bettering yourself and preparing yourself to go back into that environment. But for at least a year, mm-hmm. I get to just breathe and think about what I need to take care of, which is that's a nice transition.
And what has been your time like in the, I use the classroom to mean the sort of academic experience. Has it been also just kind of fun to have your brain be able to go in different places in that regard?
Yeah, it's awesome. I didn't realize how sheltered you get from issues that are domestic while you're in the military. It's kind of strange. You hear all these hot topic issues like healthcare, for instance, but when you're in the military, you're only thinking about the area of responsibility of your unit. So in this last case, it was the Middle East, and then more specifically, exactly what country you're going to on your next deployment. And that consumes your thought, and everything else is just taken care of. When I need to go to the doctor or the dentist, I just call and I just go. And there's no payment, there's no paperwork. It just, everything happens for you exactly as you think it should. And then you kind of lose sight of all of the domestic issues that are going on outside of that. Nobody's poor that I work with. Nobody's a drug addict that I work with. You know, because everybody in my environment, in my bubble, is in the same boat. Mm-hmm. So stepping out of that and taking these classes where we are looking at issues that the rest of the country is mm-hmm. dealing with, that's an experience I haven't had in a while, just because everything has been foreign policy and everything that's domestic is similar or the same across the board for everybody around me. So I think that's been a pretty cool experience so far.
Michael, when you get to Brown and your first day of class or your 100th day of class, are you thinking, my framework has changed, or I'm just curious about the transition, like the mental transition, the physical transition, the like the schedule. I mean, all those different things that come in as you.
You don't have to take a PFT this semester.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't have to take a physical fitness test.
Okay, all right.
Which is a standard every year. You have to take a physical fitness test.
So I do see you at the gym very early in the morning.
Yeah, and so those certain things, and that's actually what I was going to allude to, is in terms of mental processes and any major changes between the Marine Corps and now here as a student, a lot of things have stayed the same because the military is quite frankly, is just ingrained in me and instilled in me and will always be. And so whether it's something like being disciplined enough to stick with a regimented schedule, that stays the same. But there have certainly been changes in terms of the mental processes going from a leader of a small unit of Marines to really an independent student trying to decide what I want to do for the rest of my life. And the change is hard, but I think that it has been a very, very interesting and enjoyable ride for me personally. Part of the reason why I got out was because I've just always been intellectually curious and really thirsty for learning. And I got to a point in the Marine Corps where I didn't see enough opportunities for me to sort of scratch that itch or satiate that thirst for knowledge in a really rigorous learning environment. There's certainly plenty of learning opportunities in the Marine Corps, don't get me wrong, but I was looking for something else. And so the change that occurred on campus was a welcome change. I was ready for this. I was wanting this. But I've noticed that I've just grown and matured.
I think that, and this is probably more as a result of me than the Marines, but I think that in the Marines, you kind of just wanted a quick answer to things, you know, like, and not in a negative way, but for example, even just like you know, when you're disassembling, you know, your rifle or something like that. Because I didn't really shoot that much until I got more into shooting when I was in the military. And I, you know, I thought I'm a really huge fan of just like the teaching marksmanship. I mean, because I learned so much and I really enjoyed that process. But it's just like things like that, there's just a quick answer. It's just like you don't really take time to think about, you know, why something works this way or why is it that this is the process of like, you know, disassembling this IED is like this. Or, I mean, I think that I was sort of naturally inquisitive for a bit of time, but particularly, I mean, in my training, I mean, I was in a platoon of 60 and there was two females. And so like, I just needed to know like the answer and I needed to articulate it confidently and quickly. And that's what was celebrated. Whereas when I transitioned over to academia, you are not rewarded for quick answers. In fact, you are
the longer the answer, the better. Yeah.
And the better questions. And I never wanted to ask questions because asking questions signified that I didn't know, you know, even though I had all these questions and I really wanted to know how things work so that I could tell people and show people and like really be confident in my leadership style. But I think that, and it was just, it's not a reflection of the Marines. It's just the reflection of like, maybe especially in my initial years as an officer of like how I needed to present myself, especially to subordinates. And I think that in the initial years of being in academia, there was a process that took place, and it wasn't always a comfortable one about being confident in asking questions. And you have to be able to, being willing to ask questions and to really kind of hone in on things in order to be able to ask better questions. And that is like sort of like the foundation of being an academic is, you know, the quality of the types of questions that you ask. And I think that definitely took time.
Yeah, no, I could totally relate to that. I will never ask a question unless I've totally exhausted all of my resources at getting to the answer without asking for help from someone else. So it is just something that's ingrained in you. It's a sign of weakness. And maybe a lot of the times in the military environment, that's a good thing because you are alone and you do have to solve problems yourself. But certainly in academia, it's just better to just ask. And so you don't burn yourself out trying to figure things that people already have figured out. So.
But you can ask the same question to like 100 different people too.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You get and see how many different answers you get.
It's true.
And you can ask the same question 100 different ways and generate like 100 different types
yes.
of conversations.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
that's, and being comfortable with that, it took time.
One of the other things that I've sort of stumbled across since getting out was this idea of time management. It sounds so silly, but I was always told that you get out, you're a Marine, and you have these skills that are highly sought after in the world, in the real world, the civilian world, things like leadership and things like time management. Mm-hmm. And then I got to Brown and I realized I actually had zero time management experience in the Marine Corps. I was always told what to do and where to be at a particular moment. So I think that has also been a really big learning point. And it sounds simple, but it is fundamental to the everyday grind of life, at least for me personally. And it was one of the biggest struggles for me upon, you know, arriving here at Brown was this idea of, okay, I have an entire day and I have a couple of classes that I need to go to. How can I best manage my time and also have, you know, things to, you know, time to do other things besides academics. And so it's been a really steep learning curve, especially at first, especially in an environment like Brown. This is one of the best learning institutions in the entire world, and it's rigorous. And you have to be able to sort of navigate that sense of ambiguity that didn't actually exist for me in the Marine Corps. So that was kind of startling to say.
You have a full day. What are you going to do?
Right, yeah. Exactly.
I want to follow up on one of Eileen's points, the bumper sticker, support your troops, but do we really know what our troops are doing? And do you find yourself teaching, especially those who maybe don't have a connection to the military, what the military is? Because it is a very small percentage of the population that serves and that has direct contact with the military, especially given sort of the number of conflicts that we are currently still in as a country. So I feel like this is one of those things that you hear in the news, but you may, you know, as a civilian, I may very rarely come in contact with the military. But I'm curious about how you have had to confront that, or, you know, what role you've played maybe in that teaching experience.
I really don't know. That's kind of a tough question. I guess to family or friends, perhaps in some capacity. And that's more just because I think, unfortunately, a lot of the times that people see troops are either in dramatizations mm-hmm. in movies or in the media because they're broken, either mm-hmm. from an injury or suffering from PTSD. There's all this suicide awareness stuff, which is great and needs to be done. But that's the only sort of publicity mm-hmm. I think a lot of people see. And at least among the people that I'm around that are not in the military, I think a perception is developed that we're broken. Mm-hmm. Like people even talk to me like, I don't know, like I should have some sort of PTSD or mm-hmm. something, you know, where that's a really small percentage and it's a significant problem mm-hmm. and those people need help, but it's also not all of us. Like a lot of us are very competent and ready to go to work mm-hmm. and integrate into civilian world. We're not, I don't know, we're not broken by the military. I think mm-hmm. that's like an important message.
I feel that personally as well. There's certainly sort of perception of who we are that the general public holds. And then I think the student, maybe I can speak to this a little bit more because I'm an undergraduate here at Brown. And so I'm deeply immersed in the undergraduate community. And in addition to those, just I think generally held perceptions by society at large, there are also a number of political perceptions about the military that you find in the everyday classroom here on campus. And so for me, I've found myself teaching or I guess helping influence the education of my peers, not so much through direct conversations about these topics, though that does occur. And I've had a couple of times, a couple of instances where a peer has, you know, just straight up asked and we've gone and grabbed coffee and we've talked about these things. But I think most of the learning or that type of interaction has simply just been by being myself and being who I am in the classroom and then having people on their own, having my peers associate the military, the Marine Corps, with me. And that's what I want. And I'm definitely willing to bear the burden and represent the military in the Marine Corps. And to me, it's an honor, actually. And so that has been certainly a rewarding experience and not one that I was seeking when I decided to matriculate. I was really concerned with myself. I wanted to take this as an awesome opportunity to develop myself and get an education and pursue the goals that I have in mind and live a happy life and things like that. This has been a pleasant reward, has been that opportunity to sort of be a peer and be a classmate and be a friend, but also be a leader or a model, if you will.
Those are some really interesting points and really nicely said. And I think that to kind of jump off of something Mike was saying, I think that one thing that is ingrained, you know, in us after military training is this notion that you represent something larger than yourself. And I think that definitely that mindset, I mean, you know, I'm a girl, so like I don't have like a military haircut. Sometimes guys are a lot easier to identify in class, and you know, and people just, and I've seen students, they just kind of watch, I mean, that's the military person in class, you know, or I've, you know, and but I think that, well, so two thoughts there is just one to follow up on what Mike was saying. It's really wonderful when you have these sorts of, when you have people that are curious about your experience and want to know, and that you can actually be that accurate representative to provide, you know, an accurate picture of what the experience is like when being in the military. But more largely speaking, I think that there's sort of this dissonance. There's these assumptions about the military that perhaps students get from watching TV and watching kind of like how the military depicts what's going on in, you know, in Syria or you know, somewhere in the Middle East or, you know, or wherever. And then also there is this, I mean, that's like one end of the spectrum. And on the other hand, I would argue at many times there's a lack of curiosity about what the experience really is like. And I think that this goes back to something, you know, that Brian was saying about this perception that, you know, that people are, you know, traumatized by their experience in the military and that sort of thing. And more often than not, to go back to my, you know, my example of like the military guy in the classroom with the short haircut, I mean, people more often than not are not going to seek out Mike to go get coffee to hear about his experience in the military. And, you know, at a couple of institutions I've been associated with, I've pitched a course on just a very simple course. I mean, yeah, in foreign policy, we get right to the military and nukes and these really really complex, topics involving the military, but what about just classes on the military and society? Mm-hmm. You know, so I would really, I hope that in, you know, coming years, different institutions, and it varies. I mean, I'm going to Texas A&M down there, and they're very...
They have a really rich tradition with the military.
They love
right?
it. Yeah. They love it.
Yeah.
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 And so, and that's what I love that about them, that they really valued service and they were inquisitive about service. And I hope that going forward, I mean, there's all these issues about veterans and veteran issues, which are issues, but I hope that we can kind of start at ground level and just kind of bridge the gap between, the assumptions that people make about the military, even yeah. undergraduates, even very educated undergraduates yeah. and yeah. people's levels of curiosity about
well,
the military.
Well, I think this is Brian's point, too, is that I think it gets so connected to the politics of things that the military is X or Y politically, and we can't have these two things sort of side by side, whatever the politics of an issue are. And so it gets so suffused with the polarization that exists in this country that it's hard for someone sitting on the externally to like tear or take these things apart and see them for what they are, as opposed to, oh, the military is X, whatever that assumption is that I have.
Yeah, and it's so true and so unreasonable. I mean, I've also served through the Obama administration too. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter who the president is mm-hmm. or what political party is in power. We're all still working for the president, but for the country on a more mm-hmm. grand scale. Right. So to associate us with whatever policies are being trickled down and we're the agents that are executing it. We were doing it before and we'll do it after. And it really doesn't necessarily reflect, unless, of course, we have a responsibility to speak up if something is out of line and not legal or appropriate. But in general, we're going to do what we're told. And that doesn't necessarily mean harm to a certain group of mm-hmm. people or mm-hmm. believe that it's necessarily the right approach. It's the approach that we were told to do the best job mm-hmm. executing. So,
and that's complicated.
That is complicated.
Yeah.
It's difficult to navigate
yeah.
sometimes.
Yeah.
But you can always focus on your job and your portion of that job and do it as well and as ethically as possible,
yeah.
given the circumstances. So.
The last question really touched on something that is near and dear to my heart, and it's this idea of schools like Brown, I think, should bear more of a responsibility to have more of us here. So
100%.
That these, because I know that the conversations or a student saying, hey, I'd love to come grab coffee with you to chat about your military experience, that's few and far in between. But that everyday learning just by being in the room and you know, bearing the burden of representing the military at large, that should be facilitated even more because let's face it, the students who come to a school like Brown go on to become the next global leaders. And so it is very important for them to understand things like, this is how the GI Bill facilitated my life. I went from being homeless and living on the streets to having an incredible opportunity and a life with my wife and my family that would never have happened mm-hmm. had I not been a Marine. And so I think it is important for the next global leaders to understand these stories and to, it's of course important to talk about things like nuclear proliferation and the role of the military in an international order. But also it's important to talk about those day-to-day, how does this affect society? And that begins with a conversation amongst peers in a particular environment. In college is the best environment for that, in my opinion, to bridge that gap between assumptions and in asking questions, or really the civil military divide that we hear about. And so schools like Brown, I think, are the right place to do that. And I think that there is, I can make a number of arguments that could say there's a moral responsibility to facilitate this type of community. And so it's heartening to see some of the changes that have been going on and to, you know, even have an opportunity to speak on a podcast like
yeah.
this. It really is indicative of exactly what I'm referring to. So thanks, I guess, for having us.
Well, no, but to advocate for yeah. a class like Eileen's, military and society,
yes.
I mean, we talk about diverse curriculum, but I think sometimes it can be somewhat of a narrow view as well. Well, thank you all for your time. Thank you for your service. But also just thank you for being so candid in your answers as well. I think it's important to not only amplify your voices, but just to have this perspective as well, which I think you guys have all touched on. We don't get enough of on campuses. So thank you again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. Great. And letting us talk.
This episode of Trending Globally was produced by Dan Richards and Jackson Cantrell. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. I'm Sarah Baldwin. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps others find the show. For more information about this and other shows, go to watson.brown.edu. Thanks for listening, and tune in 2 weeks for another episode of Trending Globally.